welcome to the House of Comments. This is a podcast about politics. Been taking a little break for a while, but decided to do another one of my one-off specials this time because of the frankly unprecedented and somewhat bizarre situation that's going on with the Labour leadership contest at the moment, which has a number of different facets, which I'm going to explore with my guest today, who I'm delighted to say is Ian Dunt, who is editor of politics.co.uk. Hi, Ian.
Hello.
Hi, what do you make of this?
Well, there's a lot to say, isn't there? I mean, firstly, I have to say it's extremely enjoyable. And I mean that sort of politically, but also journalistically, that it's given us all a story to focus on over the summer, where usually there's no traffic to any website whatsoever. And it gives us all something to talk about. But ultimately, really, what we're looking at is, you know, the complete deterioration of party politics under the sort of centrist mold that it's been in for the last 30 years. It happens to be happening to Labour. I think the same thing could easily be happening to the Conservatives. And when they sit there smiling and laughing about it, I think they would probably do them well to be a little bit more cautious in their response, because I don't think this is just a Labour problem. I think this is about the ability of modern political parties to reflect the desires of the electorate.
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that, because, I mean, I've, you know, from my perspective as a kind of long-term political commentator, I have struggled to understand what's happening when you filter it through the prism of the rules, in quotes, which are that, you know, parties, if they want to win power, have to tack to the centre, and the whole kind of Blairite New Labour thing. I mean, I did observe, I mean, I was very young at the time, but I did observe the agonies of Labour in the 80s, and I was certainly much more aware of what was going on in the 90s. And, you know, like I say, the rules were basically that you have to tack towards what the government are doing, whichever government's in power, you know, from opposition. And, you know, if you run on a hard left or even fairly left platform, then you're going to be slaughtered, basically. And it seemed like that was the settlement that both parties had accepted. And yet what we're seeing is that Labour have now, well, it looks, I mean, you know, it's possible I could be proved wrong given how the polls were before the general election, but I would be utterly, utterly astonished. In fact, I will. Here we go. I will eat my hat if Jeremy Corbyn, and I actually will. I will purchase a hat and I will eat it. So this isn't a Nash down empty promise. I will eat my hat if Jeremy Corbyn is not elected leader. So it is looking incredibly likely that that's going to happen, and that puts us into, as you say, an unprecedented situation for over 30 years. The last time there was a leader of Labour that was anything like as left-wing as Jeremy Corbyn is was Michael Foote in the early 80s. I mean, I almost don't really know where to begin talking about this. What do you think will happen as and when he becomes leader? You know, there's things like he has refused, he's already indicated that he won't join the Privy Council, which is something that automatically all leaders of the opposition do. And it's sort of a necessity in our system because they can't get briefings on security matters unless it's under Privy Council rules. So if he's not a member of the Privy Council, he won't get the security briefings that leader of the opposition kind of has to have in order to be able to, you know, respond to political events with the knowledge that they need. And, you know, just the fact that so many of his policies are so far left wing that many of his own MPs are, it's looking like they won't be prepared to stand for them. He might not even be able to fill a full shadow cabinet slate. I mean,
it's true, although my guess is that some of his democratic ambitions in terms of how the Labour Party is constituted internally will actually be what allow his critics to stay on, because it'll give them an avenue, and what I think will probably be an extremely effective avenue for getting rid of him. So if he has, you know, elections, if he has some kind of democratic voice in how people are constituted for the shadow cabinet, my guess is people will stick around because they'll want to create a shadow cabinet of enemies. And Christ knows he's got more than enough of them in the parliamentary party. It's hard to think, as you say, of him being able to fill it up his own selections. So the first thing that happens there is there will be some quite explicit, really well above the water sort of attacks on his leadership, which have, you know, every likelihood of being able to get rid of him in the first couple of years. However, it has to be said, I don't really go in for this idea that, I mean, a lot of people sort of saying, well, look, fine, it's going to go with Corbyn now, but there'll be local elections soon. When they see how disastrous it is, they'll get rid of him. But I'm not actually sure it will be disastrous for them. I don't think Labour can win a general election with Jeremy Corbyn at all. I think, in the last sort of 6 weeks or 2 months or so of a general election, a Linton Crosby would just pour out fear about what him destroying the economy, and it would be extremely effective. But I think in the time leading up to a general election, the level of public support for him, I'm guessing, will actually be very high. Because I think people love the idea of a straight-talking everyman who, you know, he's not manicured, he's not put together in this PR sort of way, he's got this massive, you know, thing holding his glasses in his breast pocket, he looks like his hair hasn't been done up, using normal language and challenging the Westminster elite. So in a very Nigel Farage, Alex Salmond, Nicola Sturgeon-y sort of way, I actually think he'll be very popular, and that the initial period of his leadership will be taken up with lots of stuff in the media about, oh, look at how well he's doing, and isn't this frightening?
Yeah, I mean, the way you've laid it out there seems entirely plausible to me, that we could well have a situation where he gets the typical honeymoon bounce that all new leaders get anyway, but with an extra edge, because, as you say, he answers a straight question with a straight answer. Mm. And that is refreshing. I mean, I found it refreshing to listen to him being interviewed. He just sounds like a normal person. It's like when you see the other Labour leadership candidates, I tweeted this the other day, every time they're asked a question, you can see the calculation behind their eyes as they're trying to answer the question. Mm. Whereas with Corbyn, he just answers it immediately. And I had some responses on Twitter saying, well, that's not a good thing. You know, surely you should think about your answers before you give them. But that was slightly missing my point. It's not that they're thinking about the answers. They're triangulating their answers all the time. They're thinking, right, so if I say that, then who's that going to offend? So I won't say that. So and how can I? Yvette Cooper is particularly guilty of this, in that her answers are so bland often that they're almost meaningless. But all the other leadership candidates, to a lesser or greater extent, are guilty of that. And Corbyn just simply isn't. It's like he hasn't been in politics for the last 30 plus years. And I suppose, given that he's been, you know, an outspoken backbencher, and he's ploughed his own furrow, and he hasn't been bothered about ministerial office or following any of the diktats of the kind of new Labour machine, it's maybe understandable. In a way, he sort of understands the game, but he's not willing to play the game. So he's not like a complete naive newcomer who doesn't understand the rules of politics. He does, but he's just not willing to play the game the way it's been played for the last 30 years.
Yeah, and I mean, it's particularly noticeable given, you know, the poverty of talent among his rivals. I mean, they really, you know, you can make the argument that people make of, look, don't you want Labour to be electable? I think that's a lot easier argument to use against him if it looked like any of the other people running for the leadership were capable of winning an election at all. And in fact, as you say, Yvette Cooper, who actually I think probably is intellectually the most impressive of all four of them, has put up one of the most sort of offensively apolitical campaigns I've ever seen. She's only bothered to even make a single political statement in the last 2 or 3 weeks. Before that, she just studiously avoided politics altogether and speaks in this dreadful sort of mock sincere tone. Andy Burnham has adopted, I mean, I think at last count, about 6 different positions through this leadership campaign. And now, I mean, must be considered deeply, deeply inconsistent, and probably, you know, quite ungenuine as well. And Liz Kendall really has completely failed to spell out what a Blairite agenda would look like. I mean, that's clearly what she's going for. All she really seems aware of are the Blairite tactics. But, you know, even I, as an opponent of Blairism, and I sort of really quite hate New Labour and all it did, I did recognise at least that Tony Blair had something he was working towards. There was an agenda there, and the rest of it was tactical. All she's got is the tactics, and there's no strategy behind it. So I think the reason that these qualities of his stick out quite as much as they do are because the others are so bad. They won't stick out quite as much with David Cameron, but, you know, David Cameron still does exactly the things that you're saying. He talks in this sort of passive managerial tone, which is used to defend himself against attacks and to not reveal the specifics of what he intends to do. And when you put a guy like that up against a guy like Jeremy Corbyn, who talks plainly, the public tend to like the latter. Now, that won't withstand the battering that Linton Crosby will give him, which is about, look, this man is going to destroy the economy, your mortgage will be worth nothing, your bank account will be worth nothing. It won't sustain that, but it will get him through a few years of news nights and question times and PMQs.
Yeah, and that's interesting what you say there, because I read a piece by, I think it was Alex Massey in The Spectator the other day, where he said that the more he sees of Jeremy Corbyn, the more he's reminded of Michael Dukakis in the 1988 US presidential campaign, where the Republicans apparently internally used the term strip the bark off him, where they associated him very closely with someone who he'd when he was, I think, when he was governor of a state somewhere. He, I think it might have been Massachusetts. He released him from prison, and he went off to then he absconded. It was like a weekend release thing. He absconded and then stabbed someone and raped a woman. And this was just thrown back at him over and over again during the 1988 US presidential campaign. And apparently, we know it was very effective because George Bush Senior won that election campaign. I wasn't too aware of that at the time, but I wonder if that analogy could actually be very telling, because how many different ways will the Tories and Lyndon Crosby, or if it's not Crosby, whoever replaces him, have to strip the bark off Jeremy Corbyn? I mean, you've only got to see some of the pictures that we've seen of him with Gerry Adams in the 1980s, and some of the other people he shared platforms with. I mean, I actually think it's incredibly unfair to to say that he to show pictures of him with Gerry Adams and almost imply that he's somehow responsible for what the IRA did. I mean, when he's been asked about it, he hasn't really been willing to specifically condemn what the IRA did. He's just condemned all violence, and I think that's where he's come from here, that he does condemn all violence, and he always tries to find a solution to the violence, and that's why he was talking to people from the IRA in the 1980s. And the truth is, so were the British government. They were pretending they weren't, but behind the scenes, that was exactly what they were doing. So, I mean, things like that. The problem is, I'm being, I think, quite fair-minded about this, and I don't necessarily agree with all of Corbyn's policies, but on that sort of issue. But as you say, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months in the run-up to an election campaign, he will just be absolutely battered. And the pictures of him with Gerry Adams and pictures of him with perhaps Muslim extremists in more recent years, there will be dozens and dozens and dozens of those pictures, and they will just be republished and republished. And he just will not be given a chance and a hearing. If they did what they did to Ed Miliband, when there wasn't that much they could really go for him on, you could imagine what they'll do with someone like Corbyn's history.
I do think that there's a distinction between the economic attacks, which I think will be very effective, and the stuff that's around his associations with Islamic fascists and with the IRA and his views on the Falklands. And I'm not quite so convinced that that latter stuff works, actually. I mean, it tends to be that when it's something that happened 20 years ago, when it's an association with a friend, the public always seem to be very forgiving. And I don't mean with Corbyn particularly, I mean in general. I mean, you only have to look at Farage and the number of associations he has with people who are just coming out with the most dreadful racist tosh. And there'll be a week of it leading the headlines, and then a poll gets released and it's shown he's taken absolutely no damage for it whatsoever. And I think that's specifically for people who are seen as straight talkers. Those kind of questionable associations are seen as less of a problem by the public, almost as a sort of a necessary price you pay for a kind of bloke like that. I do actually think, I mean, you're quite right about the IRA thing, and there's a lot of dreadful rubbish that's spoken about, this phrase shared a platform with, as if you sort of morally are imbued with all of the views of the person who you happen to have sat next to on a panel. I mean, I, at the extremely minor sort of junior level of political journalism, sit on all sorts of panels with people who I don't know what all of their politics are like, and I certainly wouldn't stand up to justify it. So that stuff's nonsense. But I think in truth, he probably has, over the course of the last 30 years, done that quite classic hard left error of thinking the enemy of the enemy is my friend, and probably did get a bit too chummy with some pretty nasty Islamic sort of characters. It doesn't mean that he shares their views, and the stuff about the anti-Semitism is a dreadful slur on his character. But nevertheless, there'll be plenty of stuff there where he probably did get a little bit too chummy with these people simply because they shared the same enemy, that being, the British government and Western foreign policy.
I mean, from what you said earlier on, it sounds like you think there's actually a reasonable chance he might last the 5 years and he won't be ousted by his colleagues.
Yeah, that's an odd one, and I wouldn't want to put any bets on that one way or another. I think the twin things, as I sort of alluded to at the start, the first one is that if he does what he says he's going to do internally for the Labour Party, he will facilitate the kind of situation which will make his position less secure. Those democratic reforms will be exactly what the Parliamentary Party uses to get rid of him. But on the counterbalance, I think he's going to very quickly build a commanding poll lead. I mean, very commanding indeed. I mean, it happened, of course, under Miliband with Labour. It doesn't mean anything for the general election result. But almost as soon as Miliband was elected, he built this really quite strong, I think it was an 8-point lead. I would expect Corbyn to get a 15-point lead or more as the little guy taking on the Tories, and people will like that when they don't have to vote on the specifics of what it might entail. So I think there's two twin sort of counterbalancing concerns. I'm not quite sure which way that will all work out, but I think those will be the two things that are most important in the months to come.
Yeah, because I've heard reports that internally his parliamentary colleagues are saying that, well, yeah, that's all well and good, and he can have a few months, but he said stuff about the Scottish election, and he said stuff about local elections and how he's going to rebuild and so forth. And so, you know, we'll go for him immediately after those. But, you know, the problem is that, as you say, there are quite often poll boosts with new leaders. And I mean, I'm not saying that Scottish Labour will do brilliantly next year, but I could certainly imagine that they'll do better than what are already probably pretty low expectations, given what happened at the general election. So the bar's set pretty low. They seem to be thinking he won't even be able to clear that, whereas I actually agree with you. I think he's far more likely to clear a pretty low bar like that, and then probably the same in local elections over the course of the next couple of years, and if there are any by-elections. Again, because people aren't voting for a government, it's a protest vote. The Conservatives are still making quite big cuts. They're not hugely popular either. So I think it could be quite easy for him to score a couple of shock successes, which in reality will probably be low-hanging fruit, but may not seem like that. And that will set him up for maybe more years to come and give him a decent shot at remaining in place by 2020. And, you know, when the kind of scenario we've already talked about could easily happen, and Labour could then be on below 200 seats if it goes as disastrously as I fear. I don't think he deserves that, by the way. I think he deserves to be heard, and he deserves for people to vote for him or not on the basis of his policies. Unfortunately, I'm a bit too old and a bit too cynical, and I've seen it too many times now to know that that's not really how general elections work, sadly.
Yeah, I think that's very unlikely, and I do think he will lose it. And the you know, overall, over the 5 years, the chances are there could well be some kind of split, depending, I think, a lot of it will depend on Tim Farron, really, and just how compelling a vision of a sort of moderate, very centre-lefty programme he puts forward. I mean, I think if the leader had been someone like Kendall or Cooper, who, you know, all of a sudden don't seem so different anymore compared to Corbyn, that is, then Tim Farron would have ploughed much further to the left. But instead, his incentives will be to, you know, try to be the sort of centrist wing of the Labour Party. Mm-hmm. And if he puts forward a very compelling vision there, there'll be more of an incentive for people on the centre of Labour and on the right of Labour to just jump ship and move over there and try to create a new grouping.
I mean, I guess the problem is that we're looking at this now, and because we're sort of through the looking glass, it is almost impossible. I'd be very reluctant to put any money on any of the things that I've said on this on this podcast. I'd probably be reluctant to put any money on any of it for the next couple of years, really, just because we're in, like I say, within my political, my political commentary lifetime. This is unprecedented. And I did, before we just wrap up though, Ian, I did just also want to talk about another aspect of this story, which frankly has really, really annoyed me. I don't know what your views on this, but the whole Labour purge thing that's been going on. I mean, we've got a situation where, one of the main political parties in this country has hugely increased its membership and has also managed to get other kind of categories of membership on board, people who are described as supporters, and I think there are also people who are kind of union affiliates who have specifically decided to opt in. So it's been a proactive step that they've taken rather than the kind of passive, union affiliation it used to be. So again, you've got an almost unprecedented situation where the number of members stroke supporters of the Labour Party have increased compared to the previous leadership election 5 years ago. I think it's gone up fivefold, the number of people who are actually eligible to vote in terms of being a member or a supporter. It's like an incredible situation. And yet, what they've managed to do is take this situation where they've got all of these new members, presumably quite a lot of whom are enthusiastic, and they may well be joining to vote for Jeremy Corbyn, but they're enthusiastic about politics, a little bit like we saw in Scotland. But instead of doing what the SNP did, which is welcome these people on board and try and modify their structures to take account of them and take advantage of all the new ground troops that they've got, Labour have picked up a gun, loaded it, aimed it at the foot and fired it. Because They're trying to actually kick out a load of these members, trying to claim that they don't support Labour values, in quotes. We've had situation with, like, the comedian Mark Steele, who's very left-wing, also the comedian Jeremy Hardy, who's very left-wing. They've been banned from joining Labour as a supporter, even though I can't really imagine what possible justification they could have. And it's not just that thousands of people, it's 3,000 at the last count, but I suspect it's going to be more. And it's not only that, they're doing this after people have received their ballot papers, and they're even going to do it after they voted. So it's almost like, what it feels to me is that this would not be happening if anyone other than Jeremy Corbyn was the front runner. And they're going through and they're kind of post hoc saying, right, okay, what can we do to try and reduce the number of people who vote for Jeremy Corbyn? I'm struggling to see this filtered through any other lens. Can you maybe, have you got a less cynical perspective on this?
I think you're completely correct. I think that is exactly what has happened. The Labour Party has never been a particularly democratic organisation. It isn't now. It's always been very authoritarian. They jettisoned almost all of the socialism stuff, apart from the authoritarian way of managing a party internally. But, you know, Blair doubled down on that sort of thing. He made it even less democratic than it was before. And that's the same character of the party that it has now. These arguments that it's using are completely bananas. I mean, this idea that because someone, you know, might have voted for, you know, whatever this National Health Action Party was, or for Respect a couple of years ago, they now can't be a supporter of the Labour Party now, is just completely mad and shows just the level of rigid, unintellectual, disrespectful attitude towards its own members that the Labour Party has. So I agree, like, the last few days in particular, I mean, it's been bad for the last few weeks, but the last few days in particular have really shown the Labour Party at its utter worst. And I'm afraid to say, I think that that is its true face.
It does seem absolutely crazy to me. You've got a situation where, I mean, I mentioned Jeremy Hardy. Apparently he did a fundraiser for Carolyn Lucas in Brighton Pavilion just before the general election to raise some money for her. Of course, she's a Green Party candidate. It's quite clear that in Brighton, there are lots of natural Labour supporters who voted for Carolyn Lucas because they share her values and she shares their values. So the idea that Jeremy Hardy doesn't share Labour's values, no, that's wrong. What he's done is help raise a little bit of money for someone who managed to take a seat off Labour, or take a seat that Labour probably considers to be theirs by right. And therefore, he's persona non grata. And I tweeted this the other day, and I was being a little bit facetious. But at the same time, this is absolutely true, that Sean Woodward in 1999 was a Tory front bench spokesperson. He'd been, I think he was chairman or deputy chairman of the Conservative Party, and he defected from the Tories to Labour. He'd been with the Tories for 10 years. He'd been a backroom person. He'd launched all sorts of terrible attacks on Labour, the Labour Party and Labour ministers and so forth. They welcomed him with open arms immediately, without any question. He was in, you know, it was a great coup for them. Well, how can he be allowed to join the Labour Party? And someone who might have mentioned to a canvasser that they were thinking of voting Respect a few months ago, then not be allowed into the Labour Party. It's absolutely insane.
It's completely nonsensical. And of course, it's, you know, if you remember the way that Labour treated Ken Livingstone when he first ran for mayor and eventually stood as an independent and beat them that way, then the better aspect of the Labour personality is just the pragmatism of then going, OK, well, look, you're clearly a winner, so come back into the party. Mm. And that pragmatism isn't on show here. What exactly, as you said earlier, when you get an influx of members, the last thing you do is start trying to churn them all out. You say, well, look, this is an exciting thing we have. How do we change this so that these guys can become our new foot soldiers, so that we can build the kind of grassroots organisation that could counter the Tories at election time with the money that they have, and yet still manage to get the people out knocking on those doors? That is not something that they've done. They've obviously gone for the Stalinesque option instead, and I think surprising absolutely no one.
Yeah, because I'll stop this in a minute, because we obviously agree, but what they could have done is they could have done their best to try and convert most of these supporters into full members. And like you say, use them as foot soldiers. And, you know, can you imagine at by-election time, if you could pour tens of thousands of people into that seat to go knock on doors? I mean, it's what the Lib Dems used to do very successfully. You know, Labour could be a potent political force if they could leverage that new membership. And You know, it's not just the people they've cast out. It's all the terrible publicity that they've got from having done that anyway. I'm sure a lot of the people who've joined as either new members or supporters will be sitting back and thinking, what have I actually joined here? What are they doing? You know, even the ones who've somehow survived the cull will be thinking, that's not right. I'm sure a lot of them will be thinking that's not right. And will probably be a lot less enthusiastic about, you know, doing stuff within the Labour Party than they would have otherwise been.
I mean, I had a lot of friends come up to me after the election, people who were horrified by a Tory victory, and said, look, oh, I'm going to join Labour, or I'm going to join the Lib Dems. And I have to say, I always tell anyone who says that not to join any political party, because I think none of them are worthy of them, frankly. But with the Labour guys, already the kind of text that I'm getting of just saying, you know, what is this? And I didn't have any idea it would be an organisation that would behave in this sort of way. So any of that goodwill, and not least that genuine sense of excitement and dynamism that is surrounding those rallies for Corbyn, all of that has been lost in a way that it frankly didn't need to. And I mean, sort of in closing on this one, I mean, I think that that is part of what we're seeing with why Corbyn is succeeding in the first place. And I think which explains a lot of things going on across Europe with, you know, Podemos and Syriza and on the right as well. And even in the States with the rise of someone like Donald Trump. And that is the total failure of our modern political parties to reflect the changing demands that have been wrought on countries by globalization. And in fact, that drive towards membership and the fact that Labour is so uncomfortable with it and in fact looks to dispel it rather than seize upon it, tends to show you that sort of disconnect between people's desires for politics as it stands right now and the ability of modern political parties to accommodate it.
Absolutely. It's a depressing thought to end on, but I'm afraid I agree with you. All right. Okay. Well, thanks very much, Ian. It's been great to have you on again. It just remains for me to thank Audio Boom, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incomputech.com for our theme music. Thank you.